Good evening. Everybody can hear me? Courtesy of this. You don't like it this way? Sounds the same to me. So the three of us, because there's three tunes. So we're going to go with, hi Mary. We're going to go with Tom Darter's piece. Bruce is going to tell us all about that and what to listen for.
The Livermore Symphony approached me and said, we would like you to write a piece to commemorate our 50 seasons as the community orchestra here in the Tri-Valley area. And of course, I said, yes. Started talking about it with Alan Frank, and it became very clear that what was needed was some kind of celebration. So the obvious thing is, what kinds of music are celebrations? First thing comes to mind, a fanfare. But they wanted a 7-minute piece. I do not think a 7-minute fanfare would be a good idea. So I started to think about what other kinds of pieces are celebratory. And the two that came to me are a chorale, which can be a hymn of praise, a hymn of thanks. In any case, another way of celebrating. And then finally, of course, once you're done with all of the heavy stuff, you celebrate by dancing. So that is where the name of the piece came from. And because there are three sections, it can't be celebration, it has to be celebrations. Fanfare, chorale, and dance. Now, the thing is, I didn't want to just start with a bunch of trumpets blaring because I wanted it to sort of rise out of something. So there's an intro before the fanfare. The first note you hear will be a very loud note on the timpani. And as that note dies away naturally, it won't be damped, it'll just die away naturally, the tuba player, who has started very quietly, underneath that very loud timpani note, will increase in volume, so at some point what you're going to hear is the sound of the timpani changing into the sound of the tuba. And that happens 4 or 5 more times in that introductory section, using always the timpani, but then celli and trombones. And the three notes that the timpani focuses on, F, C, and G, become the notes out of which the fanfare grows. But of course, the fanfare doesn't just start, because we started with this sort of primordial soup of notes from the timpani. So when the fanfare starts, it again builds up from something not completely formed. It starts with the timpani and the strings, pizzicato, and then the tuba joins in again, of course, have some woodwind accompaniment, and then brass start to add comments here and there. And then eventually there's a full-throated version of the fanfare with all the brass, which is then answered by all the woodwinds. Now, as the fanfare dies down, the chorale starts. But again, it's like waves. The chorale doesn't wind up being there fully formed. The chorale has 4 phrases, and you hear each of the phrases played by a different group of woodwinds in a different key, while other groups of woodwinds make comments that are based on what's left of the fanfare. So the fanfare is fading out as the chorale is fading in. And then you hear the fanfare, pardon me, the chorale, in its one full statement in the strings. And then after that, the brass decide they want to have something to do with the chorale, so they do the various phrases, again, in different keys. And then I bring back a little bit of the intro with the timpani and other instruments. And then there's this little tiny transition section. It's like an 8-bar, 2-part invention that gets things revved up, and then the dance starts. But of course, as with the other things, it doesn't start fully formed. The first thing you hear sounds like a dance, but it turns out that's just the accompaniment. And then the actual first part of the dance proper starts a few bars later. This is all in the strings. And the strings sort of try and bring the dance into focus. And once they get it into focus, the woodwinds say, okay, it's our turn. And they play the first full version of the dance. Then there's a little bit of call and response, change of key. And then the woodwinds get to do their version of the not quite formed version of the dance. And then, at the climax, all hell breaks loose. Basically, what you have is the strings in unison playing the fully formed version of the dance, the entire brass section bringing the hymn back, and the woodwinds trying very hard to make themselves heard, playing sections of the fanfare. All of it happening at the same time. Who thought of that? Anyway. After that, there's a short coda. I bring back a little bit of the introduction. There's a little bit of the call and response, the key change. There's a tiny bit of a reminder of the fanfare, a tiny bit of the reminder of the final version of the dance. And then we're done. So there's a very quick cadence and goodbye. And I hope you all enjoy it. Thank you very much.
You can hear me just as well if I sit down. I'm going to talk to you about what to listen for in the concerto, the Brahms violin concerto. And you've got some program notes there, but what I'm going to talk about, I don't think you have. I haven't read the program notes yet. I scanned them once to see if there are any mistakes, but I don't remember what I said or what I heard or what I read. I found myself singing the principal melody of the first movement. And I found, gosh, that's not the first melody. That's not even the concerto. Why am I confusing the concerto principal melody with the principal melody of the Second Symphony of Brahms? The reason I figured out is they're both in the same key, they both go at the same speed, they both are in 3/4 time. The Second Symphony goes with a what we call a chordal melody, a whistle. Scale. 3-5-5-1-2-3-2-1-5, or in solfege. Mi, so, so, do, re, mi, re, do, so, dum, 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 dum. It starts right out with this broken chord melody. It's in D major. Well, that's the violin concerto. Violin concerto starts out. Dee, da, da, dee, dum, da, dee. Da, da, da. All those chord tones from the tonic triad. 1-3-1-6-5-3-5. Do mi so mi do so mi re. That's not a good stopping note to finish, but it's a good note for the end of that phrase. So that's why I get confused. Melodies are usually built of two things. Sometimes very close together, sometimes bits and pieces. A scale or parts of scale. Now you all remember the sound of music. Do, re, mi, no, do, re, mi, da, di, da, di, da, 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 do, re, mi, and so forth. That's scalar. And you're going to hear a lot of scale melodies also. But the other option is to do a melody that starts out with chord tones. Whoops. Mm-hmm. melodies that embrace the chord tones of the tonic triad. Well, that's what to listen for. That's one of the things to listen for. But that's how he kicks off the beginning. And like most concertos, not all, the orchestra states all the material first. And then the violin sort of sneaks in and restates it. There's a middle section where we sort of destroy the key, move in other places, do other things with the material, and then there's the recapitulation. There's restating the material all over again, but maybe with a little different orchestration. Second movement. The soloist is going to just stand here for a long time because he doesn't get to play for about the first 20, 25, 26 bars. The principal oboe player who's sitting here knitting, I think, or doing something. Yeah, she's knitting. I don't know what's looking, Madeline Lafarge, I don't know what she's knitting. But I forced my whistle tonight. Yeah. Scale there. All he skips and jumps from chord tone to chord tone. I suspect the reason that Brahms wrote it initially for the oboe is that once she takes a breath, unlike any other wind player, she can play for a longer piece of time than anybody else. And so you're just gonna check out the watch and see. How long is she going to blow before she takes a breath? That's a little game there. Well, we figured that out, and sometimes we're just playing cheat. The last movement is a sort of a Hungarian dance, and you're going to hear the violin and the orchestra start exactly the same time. Now, the fiddle player is playing in double stops, playing two notes at the same time, either thirds or sixths. Yum, ba 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 bum, ba 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 bum 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 bum. What's underneath that? Well, I told the orchestra one time, think of playing a Hungarian guitar. That sounds like it to me, and maybe you think so too. The person who responsible for much of the music for this concerto and the usual cadenza is a fellow, Brahms, a couple of years younger than Brahms, but at the time the most famous solo violinist in Europe, Johann Joachim, who helped him greatly to compose the cadenza and helped him with other statements too. Joachim was not only a fine violinist, fine conductor and composer. The other solo violinist, Sarasate, name me another one. Right. They were interested in music in enhancing their own stature, their ego. Joachim didn't do that. He went, and as so many German composers did from Handel on, went over to England, back and forth, and did his concerts over there. He was in service of the music. Now I have to tell you one thing. Stuart Kanin is not going to play that cadenza. I wrote him a cadenza, and he's going to play my cadenza. And what's supposed to happen in the cadenza? Well, it's a unencumbered offering of all the material that's gone before. That's what cadenzas do. It's like, well, Beethoven did it. He just, no one knew what he was going to do in the cadenza. He would just sort of play by ear and fool around with all the material until we come back and finish it up with the orchestra. Well, we don't quite do that so much anymore, but Quite often people will compose their own cadenza in the style that we used to do that. Some of the cadenzas are sometimes too long and they're out of style, they didn't use the right harmonies, they get too modern. But this cadenza that he's playing is a very good one. He likes it. And so I'll do my best to keep us all together.
And I'm going to tell you a little bit about Brahms' First Symphony and the fact that it is often referred to as Beethoven's 10th symphony. And this is a moniker that it received just about a year after it was premiered. So this is something that has been around for a long time. And the story is this. It starts in 1827 when Beethoven dies. Enormous funeral in Vienna, a giant of music has passed on. 40,000 people attend his funeral. The population of Vienna is only 10,000 at the time. Gives you an indication of the man's draw. And he leaves such a vacuum in the compositional world that it's as if everyone exhales. And now they're just waiting for the next master to step to the fore and carry on this tradition. Well, of course, this is not to say that there aren't a lot of other qualified composers who are writing wonderful symphonic material. Of course there are. You've got Schumann, who's working and producing masterpiece work. You've got Mendelssohn. You have people who are elaborating the symphonic tradition and voice. But you also have kind of this sense where people are waiting for the next prodigy to step forward and take the symphony to the next level, to the newest height. And it's natural then to look at the prodigy who shows up, who is a prodigy both in terms of composition as well as performance, to see whether or not he's going to be the one to do this. And of course, this would be Johannes Brahms. Brahms is a protege of Schumann, and his talent is demonstrated early. He is a prodigy at the piano. He is famous for doing things like showing up at the concert hall, discovering that the piano is a half step flat, and he plays his own concerto in C sharp instead of in C, and he transposes it on the fly during the performance. Ask any pianist whether they can do that, and even Van Cliburn would say no. So, but this was Brahms, and he could do this. So Brahms is writing a lot of music. He is extending forms in every direction. He writes a lot of songs. Writes a lot of choral music, certainly lots of concerti, all kinds of stuff is coming out, but he's not writing a symphony. And everyone is noticing this, and he's been composing for a long time, but there's no symphony. Johannes, where's the symphony? And of course, people are starting to wait for that, and he's busily at work on it, but he doesn't tell anyone. And we know from the letters that he wrote to Clara Schumann that in fact he was actually working on it as early as the 1850s, but he didn't premiere it until 1876. And when the day finally comes for him to do this, he doesn't even premiere it in Vienna. He actually premieres it in Karlsruhe, which is comparatively a backwater compared to Vienna, the musical capital of the universe. But the symphony is very well received, and he goes on then to play it in Vienna. It is received well there. Audiences love it. Orchestras love it. The conductors love it. And one of the conductors, who is a personal friend of Brahms, says, "This is every bit the great symphony that we have been waiting for. He has carried on the tradition of Beethoven. He has extended it. He has elaborated on it. This is Beethoven's 10th symphony." So you can imagine that Brahms is kind of going, just like turn down the wax poetic, okay? You know, that's nice, I'm glad you like it, but, you know, let's not get carried away. The critics are not quite so taken with the piece. And one of them actually says, you know, sure, this is Beethoven's 10th, but only because you ripped him off. This is a plagiarism. And so the critic actually accuses Brahms of stealing several of the themes that Beethoven is famous for having written. And Brahms' response to this is classic. He says, of course you can hear Beethoven in this music. I wrote it as an intentional homage to Ludwig. Anyone who can't see that is an ass. Now, I apologize to anyone with sensitive ears, but this is actually what he said, and I can assure you that in German it was no less offensive. So, he is stuck between a rock and a hard place, but, you know, this is what happens when you write music. Not everyone's going to go for it. But Brahms certainly enjoys a lot of success with this symphony. He goes on immediately, within the next couple of years, to write the second, third, and fourth. And anyway, so one of the things that is seminal about this symphony is that it is chock full of melody. And of course, Brahms is great with melody. Not only does he borrow from Beethoven, but he is completely original. He writes his own. They are all wonderful pieces. And so what I thought I would do is something a little different. One of the themes that is famous in this is the main theme of the fourth movement, the Allegro non troppo. And that's the theme that sounds like la 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 la. Now, rather than have some troubadour like myself stand up here and sing this for you, what I thought I would do instead is actually have a real musician do this. And so I have invited Christina Anderson, she is our concertmaster, to actually play this theme on the violin, the major theme of the fourth movement. And she's around here. And so as she prepares to do that, what I want you all to do as you listen to this theme is compare it by memory to the Ode to Joy and see for yourself, decide for yourself how similar or how different this theme actually is. Also see that it is a completely original theme as well. And the final thought about the First Symphony. It is widely regarded by music historians as being probably the greatest First Symphony ever written. And by that, what is meant is that the invention and the maturity that Brahms brings to it is much more advanced than any other First Symphony of other composers. And this is seen when you compare it against his fourth, for example. They're both similar in scope and in draw in terms of language that is used. Compare this to Beethoven and the difference between his first and his ninth, his last. The difference is huge. You can tell that when Beethoven wrote his First Symphony, he was just getting used to the compositional form of the symphony, and he was learning as he went. With Brahms, he was already a mature composer. He knew what he wanted to say in the symphony, and he went out and said it very well. So you'll also get a chance, by the way, to actually compare this symphony against Beethoven's Ninth, because, of course, at the end of our golden anniversary season, we will be playing it at the end of the year. So make sure you come for that as well. All right, enjoy the concert.